In the course of history, there have been many tyrants who menaced the kingdom of Christ on earth. But when things were darkest, when all hope seemed lost, for Catholics there has been one person to turn to, Our Lady Help of Christians. And yet, in this land of Australia, it is not well known that the patroness of Australia is Our Lady Help of Christians. How many children know? How many parents know? And even those who do know, how many could tell the story? I felt that I must uncover this little secret, at least for my grandchildren. And yet I confess that I also knew very little, and it was difficult to find anything comprehensive. But, as so often happens, information falls into one's hands. A bit of the story from one source, more bits from another, then from another and another, until the whole story pieced itself together. And then I saw that this is not just a story. It is truly an epic in the true sense of that word. My words won't do it justice, but we must try. Three times in history, Christendom was in terrible danger from enemies who were determined to crush Christianity. In their danger, Catholics turned to Our Lady Help of Christians for help, and each time, miraculously, she saved Christendom. Before we start, one little thing must be made clear. Some non-Catholics think that we pray to Our Lady instead of to God. Well, that's not so. What we do is pray to God through Mary. Compared to God, Mary is nothing. Nothing but a creature of God. But God loves her so much, He's always ready to grant what she asks of Him. And that is why we send so many requests to God through Mary. Today, Christianity in Australia is facing such a crisis that we must turn for help to Australia's patroness, Our Lady Help of Christians. But to understand the story, let's go back to the beginning. 2,000 years ago, when Jesus founded his church, the Roman Empire ruled much of the world. The Roman Empire was pagan, and it persecuted the new church, persecuted it for 300 years. After 300 years, there came a Roman emperor who was called Constantine the Great. He changed things. He stopped the persecutions. Constantine allowed Christians to carry on their religion in peace. He protected Christians, and eventually Constantine himself became a Christian. Christianity then spread rapidly through the Roman Empire, and it soon became the religion of the big part of the world that was the Roman Empire, stretching from Britain across Europe and North Africa to the Middle East, and down to the borders of Arabia. Now, 600 years after Jesus died, a tragedy happened for Christendom. 600 years after Christ, there lived in Arabia a man named Mohammed. His country, Arabia, was not Christian. The people of Arabia were pagans, but they did have contact with Christian people who lived nearby. Through this contact with Christian people, that is, Catholic people, the people of Arabia knew a lot about the Catholic religion. So this man Mohammed knew a lot about the Catholic religion, and he was influenced by it. Then it seems Mohammed became what we call a religious fanatic. History books tell us that Mohammed founded a new religion, the religion of Islam. The followers of the religion of Islam are called Muslims, or Muslims, or Mohammedans. However, did Muhammad start a really new religion? Well, no, he didn't. What he did do was to borrow the Christian religion and change it to suit his own ideas. For one thing, he dropped the pagan idea of many gods. As you know, the pagans worship many gods or idols. Muhammad said there is only one God, and he called that God Allah. He said that Allah is a personal God who created the world and everything. Well, so far he's made Allah look like the Christian God. But, said Muhammad, Allah is one person only, not like the Christian God of three persons in one God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. So Muhammad's Allah is very different from the Christian God. Now, what else did Muhammad borrow from the Catholic religion? He borrowed the doctrine of man's soul, man's immortal soul, also the doctrines of eternity, of eternal heaven and hell. As for the Bible, he kept the Old Testament, but not the New Testament, not the Gospels. Instead of the New Testament, Muhammad wrote his own book. He claimed that the angel Gabriel had appeared to him and had told him the real truths. And those truths he wrote down in a book which he called the Quran. This book, the Quran, became the new Bible of Muhammad's religion of Islam. Well, now the question, where did all this put Jesus Christ? Muhammad said Jesus was a great man, a great prophet like Moses, but that Jesus was not God. A great prophet and born of a virgin mother, the Virgin Mary, but not God. Muhammad honored Mary, and Mohammedans still honor Mary today, but honor her as the mother, even the virgin mother of the great man Jesus, but not as the mother of God. Muhammad said there was no original sin committed by a first man, Adam. Therefore, there was no need of a divine redeemer. He even said that Jesus was not put to death on the cross. Muhammad's religion kept a lot of Christian moral teachings, but dropped the Blessed Eucharist, and of course the Mass. And it dropped the difficulties of Jesus' resurrection from the dead. And Muhammad would have no priests. Furthermore, he said that everyone in Islam is equal, socially equal. And this appealed to the ordinary people. So Islam, the religion started by Muhammad 600 years after Christ, Islam was really a simplified Christianity. Islam was Christianity without the difficult doctrines of Christianity. And this simplicity made Islam just what many people wanted. People who found the Catholic religion difficult. Islam was just so simple. And the doctrine that everyone is socially equal, that was popular. Popular with everyone who didn't happen to be at the top of the social ladder. And that, of course, meant nearly everyone. Islam was a heresy. Nothing less than a great heresy against Christ's church. And like all heresies, Islam hated Christianity. Islam hated pagans too. It hated all who wouldn't join it. But most of all, it hated Christians. And Islam was determined to take over all Christendom. Muhammad went forth proclaiming, "There is one God, His name is Allah, and Muhammad is His messenger." Muhammad gathered many followers, and they launched fierce war, holy war they called it, against everyone, especially Christians. Muhammad promised his followers that if they died in battle, they would go straight to heaven, straight to the heaven of Allah, where they would find all the delights of the flesh. This made the Muslim soldiers tremendous fighters. They weren't afraid of death in battle, because that would mean immediate heaven. With burning zeal for the new Islam, they attacked Catholic countries, and everywhere they fought, they conquered. Millions of Catholics were persecuted until they changed their religion to the religion of Islam, or died as martyrs. And Catholic churches were destroyed, or turned into Muslim mosques. The armies of Islam conquered the Middle East and swept eastwards across to India. Islam's armies thundered westward across northern Africa and then up into Spain and conquered Spain. They advanced into France, and it seemed nothing could stop their advance into all Europe. But they were stopped in France. The Islam army was beaten back and pushed out of France by the Christian army of Charles Martel. After 100 years of victories, Islam was stopped in the West, and things stayed at that until 100 years later, when Islam took over the island of Sicily and then went up into Italy and conquered some areas of southern Italy. In 200 years, Islam had taken over the lands around the Mediterranean Sea. 1/3 of Christendom had been conquered by the Muslim armies, and they imposed the reign of Allah instead of the reign of Christ. This was the new empire of Islam, strong and fierce, yet highly cultured. And Islam was still determined to conquer all Christendom. Later, the Crusades, the wars of the Crusades, were begun by Christian nations against Islam, to try to break the power of Islam. But the Crusades were not really successful. And so, for the next few 100 years, the great empire of Islam faced the empire of Christendom and was still determined to conquer Christendom. And it nearly did so twice. And it would have done so too. It would have done so, but each time, in the hour of danger, Christendom turned for help to Our Lady, Help of Christians. We move to the middle of the 1400s. The armies of Islam had gone from victory to victory. In 1453, the Muslim Turks took Constantinople, a shattering loss for Christendom. It ended what had been so long the Eastern Roman Empire. But the next big move against Christendom was to come a century later. By then, the Turkish Empire extended from North Africa and Egypt and part of Arabia, up through Palestine, Iraq, and Syria, through its own heartland of Turkey, also the island of Crete, also Greece, the Balkan states, up to southern Russia, and part of Austria and part of Hungary. With this immense empire, Muslim Turkey was at the peak of its power, and the fanatical hate for Christians was also at its peak. In 1570, the Sultan of Turkey sent a huge fleet to attack the Christian island of Cyprus. The Turks overwhelmed the Christians, and the Turks committed unspeakable cruelties, killed 20,000 Christians, and took prisoner another 15,000. Islam was again on the march to conquer Christendom. The power of Turkey now would take Italy by sea and Austria by land. The Sultan boasted that St. Peter's Basilica in Rome would become the stable for his horses. In 1571, a mighty Muslim fleet, a Turkish fleet, put to sea with plans to take Italy and thereby open the way for the conquest of all Christian Europe for Allah. The Pope, Pius V, saw the terrible danger. He called on the smaller fleets of the several Catholic countries to form a combined Christian fleet to fight the big Turkish fleet. So the small fleets were combined into a Christian fleet which was put under the command of Don John of Austria. This commander was determined to have a truly Christian fleet. No soldier or sailor was allowed to join unless he was a good Christian. The fleet was blessed in its mission by the Pope himself. Then it sailed off with its flagship flying a blue flag showing Christ crucified. Let's remember that there was no radio in those days, no telephone, no TV. When the Christian fleet sailed away, nobody on shore would have any way of knowing what was happening to it from day to day. It sailed away into silence. During the days that followed, while the Christian fleet was sailing south and the Turkish fleet was sailing westward to attack, the Pope called on Catholics to pray unceasingly, to pray to Our Lady Help of Christians, to plead with her to save Christendom in this terrible hour. With the Pope, Christendom went down on its knees in rosaries and prayers. On the Christian fleet at sea, soldiers and sailors prayed the rosary too. Now let's have a look at the two fleets. The ships in both fleets were mainly big galleys, and in the Turkish fleet, some smaller galleots. All these ships were moved along not only by sails, they were also pulled along through the water by oars, by rows of great, long, heavy oars worked by men, with three or four men pulling on each oar. In the Christian fleet, some of the oarsmen were Muslim prisoners who were forced to work in the galleys, that is, they were slaves. Others were criminals, sentenced to work in the galleys, while others were free men who were paid to do the job. Over in the Turkish fleet, the oars were worked by thousands of Christian prisoners, thousands of Christian men who'd been captured by Muslims and forced to work the oars as slaves. The Christian fleet was a fairly big one, with slightly over 200 ships. But the Turkish fleet was much bigger, with nearly 300 ships. In the Christian fleet, Don John commanded 80,000 men. In the Turkish fleet, there were 120,000 men. On October the 7th, in the early morning, the Christian fleet was off the southern coast of Greece near the Bay of Lepanto. On today's maps, it's called the Gulf of Corinth. In the early light, they could make out the Turkish fleet on the horizon. Don John went aboard a small, fast ship and sailed along the Christian fleet holding up a crucifix and encouraging his men to fight for Christ. What a sight it must have been as the fleets moved towards each other. 500 ships under sail and with rows of great long oars that dipped and rose in rhythm. Never again would there be such a sight, because this would be the last sea battle ever fought by ships with oars. At about 11 o'clock, on every Christian ship, the men knelt on deck and a priest led them in prayers, beseeching Mary to pray for them before God. With the Turkish fleet sweeping towards them, they prayed. Suddenly the wind dropped. Then, as if in answer to prayer, the wind blew again from a different direction. Now the wind filled the Christian sails as the battle began. Each ship was armed with cannons, and each ship carried hundreds of soldiers who were armed, some as archers, some with muskets. And they would fire arrows and bullets at the soldiers on other ships. As the ships moved closer, a tactic was for a ship to try to ram an enemy ship. And then the soldiers would swarm onto the deck of the rammed enemy ship to finish the fight with swords. The battle went on for hours, and the odds were heavily against the smaller Christian fleet. But even while the battle raged, the Catholics of Europe prayed, and rosary processions went along the streets of Europe. Pope St. Pius V, in his chapel at the Vatican, prayed to Mary with arms outstretched. The tide of battle began to turn. The mighty Turkish fleet that had seemed invincible was routed. Many Turkish ships had been sunk, and 123 Turkish ships were captured. The rest retreated and sailed off. Overall, the losses were tragic. 9,000 Christians were killed, and 30,000 Turks were killed or taken prisoners. Out of the Turkish ships, Christian slaves were freed by the thousands, 12,000 in fact. 12,000 Christian men were released from slavery that day. Against all odds, the Battle of Lepanto was won on October 7, 1571, and this victory blocked the Muslim threat to Christian Europe. But how long before the news of victory could be carried back to the Pope and his people? No phones, no radio, only foot runners carrying messages. It would take days, a week perhaps, before a runner could get the news to Italy. But no, the Pope already knew. As the Turkish ships turned and retreated, the Pope on his knees had a vision in which he saw the victory. He rose from his knees and hurried to announce to the people that the Christian fleet was victorious, that Christendom was saved. And Christendom praised and thanked Our Lady, Help of Christians, for saving them that day. And to show how Catholics thanked Our Lady, the Pope instituted a new feast in her honor, the Feast of the Holy Rosary, which we still celebrate on every 7th of October, the date of the Battle of Lepanto. Lepanto was a great victory, but it was not decisive because darkness had prevented Don John from chasing the retreating Turkish ships to destroy them and finally crush the Turkish power. So Islam remained, to grow strong again later and still determined to conquer the hated Christendom. A century passed. The Turkish Empire was as powerful as ever. In 1683, the Turks launched its land army against Europe. A big Turkish army moved north to Austria and stood at the very gates of the capital city, Vienna. A Turkish army of 250,000 men laid siege to Vienna. And inside Vienna, a little Christian army of 30,000 men was all that stood between Islam and Christendom. 30,000 Catholic soldiers facing 250,000 fanatically fierce enemy. Again, Christendom seemed doomed. And again, Pope and people turned to Our Lady, Help of Christians. Pope Innocent XI commended the Christian cause to Mary, Help of Christians, and he called on all Catholics to recite the Rosary. Inside Vienna, the Christian leader was John Sobieski, King of Poland. He and his Polish soldiers prayed for help in the Chapel of Our Lady in Vienna. And the Emperor of Austria himself prayed daily in that chapel. And all the people prayed, "Mary, help us." Now, instead of defending, John Sobieski boldly attacked the huge Turkish army on September 12, 1683. The Catholic soldiers prayed, "Mary be our help," as they advanced. Yes, they advanced. The impossible had happened. The Turkish army fell back in defeat on that day, September 12, the feast day of the Holy Name of Mary. Centuries before this, a victorious Julius Caesar had proclaimed, "Veni, vidi, vici," "I came, I saw, I conquered." And now, in this hour of victory, a humbler John Sobieski declared, "I came, I saw, God conquered." Through the intercession of Our Lady, Help of Christians, Vienna was saved, and Christendom was again saved from Islam. And never since then has Islam tried to invade Christendom. There were three historic crises when Our Lady, Help of Christians, saved Christendom. We've talked about two of those crises, the Battle of Lepanto and the Battle for Vienna. The third crisis happened when Napoleon Bonaparte ruled France. In 1795, France was exhausted by the blood and the terror of the French Revolution. A new force was emerging to lead France out of the chaos. And the new force was Napoleon Bonaparte, a military genius who was becoming the strong man of France. Napoleon and his army invaded and defeated one country after another. His name became feared throughout Europe. This man had been brought up as a Catholic, but he'd lost his Catholic faith. In the year 1799, his army captured Rome. Napoleon wanted to bend the Catholic Church to suit his own ambitions, and to this purpose he had the Pope, Pope Pius VI, taken to France and imprisoned. Pius VI died in prison soon after. A new pope, Pius VII, was elected in 1800. During the French Revolution, the Catholic Church had been virtually outlawed. But Napoleon could see that France needed the old religion. Though his motives were mixed and were governed by his own interests, he arranged with the new pope a concordat, the Concordat of 1801. Whereby he re-established the Catholic Church in France. For the remainder of his rule, Napoleon's relations with Pope Pius VII were tragic, but the Pope never forgot Napoleon's action in granting the Concordat, and especially so when Napoleon was near death. In the year 1804, Napoleon had himself proclaimed Emperor of France. A few years later, by 1808, he controlled all Europe except Russia and Britain. For some years, Napoleon had bullied the Pope and the Church. Eventually, the Pope excommunicated Napoleon. Did this soften Napoleon? No, not a bit. He defiantly boasted, "Does the Pope think his excommunication will make the rifles fall from the hands of my soldiers?" Well, Napoleon had imprisoned one pope, and now he did it again. In 1809, 400 of his soldiers seized Pope Pius VII, put him in chains, and imprisoned him, first in Italy and later in France. The enemies of the Church were delighted. They reckoned that this meant the end of the papacy. Some newspapers happily proclaimed, not Pius VII, but Pius the Last. So Pope Pius VII, who was a small, weak old man, was put into prison where he received rough treatment, and in prison he stayed for 5 years. Meanwhile, Napoleon's Grand Army went on to further victories. Men began to wonder if he might go on to conquer the world. However, this pope, though imprisoned, was not finished. He made a vow to Our Lady that if she would restore freedom to the Church, he would honor her with a new feast day. He managed to smuggle messages out of prison, messages ordering the whole of the Catholic world to pray to Our Lady, Help of Christians, to help Christendom in this latest hour of danger. So the barrage of rosaries began again as Catholics prayed for help. While those prayers were going up, Napoleon set forth on his next bid for world conquest. His grand army, now a million men, invaded Russia. Again, it was the usual story. Napoleon's army advanced and continued to advance into the heart of Russia. But something was different. They could find no Russian soldiers to fight. Always the Russians had melted away without fighting, and always they laid waste to their own Russian countryside in front of Napoleon's army. Napoleon's army advanced, but into a desolate, scorched countryside. Napoleon had imprisoned the Pope. He had ambitions to conquer the world. He invaded Russia. The Russians avoided battle, but scorched the countryside. Finally, Napoleon entered the city of Moscow, but he found Moscow was a ghost city. Most of the Russians had gone, leaving the city empty and burning. Napoleon was master of Moscow, but master of a deserted, burning city, and behind him, the land of Russia that he'd marched through was also empty and desolate. Napoleon had won the strangest victory ever. With no conquered people, no crops, no cattle, no food, just emptiness. He waited in Moscow with his army, waited for the conquered Russian people to come and surrender to him. But no one came. There was little food for his army, and 1,000 miles of devastated Russian country through which his army would have to return. And worst of all, winter was beginning, the dreaded Russian winter. Napoleon decided that he had to get out of Russia and get out quickly. So the retreat began, a famous retreat from Moscow while the winter closed in. His grand army struggled on through snow and blizzard, half-starved and frozen soldiers dropping and dying in their tracks. Napoleon had once boasted, "Will the excommunication make the rifles fall from my soldiers' hands?" Now it was happening. In that frightful cold, the soldiers' rifles began to fall from hands too frozen to hold them. And now the Russian soldiers appeared, making lightning attacks on the weakened French soldiers and disappearing again. The survivors of the nightmare, who eventually struggled back to France, were no longer an army. Napoleon's grand army had been destroyed by the Russian winter. Napoleon's power was slipping away. The Pope was released from prison and set out on his return to Rome. That was in 1814. In that year, 1814, on the day of May the 24th, two events happened. On May the 24th, Napoleon was forced to sign the abdication of his power in France. And on May the 24th, Pope Pius VII re-entered Rome. On that same day, to fulfill the vow he'd made to Our Lady when he was in prison, the Pope proclaimed a new feast day of Mary, Help of Christians, to be held on every May the 24th. History records that Napoleon was imprisoned on the island of Elba, that he escaped from Elba a year later and returned to France, where his soldiers flocked to him and he raised a new army. Napoleon was again at large for the famous 100 Days, and again he became a threat to Europe. The climax came in the historic Battle of Waterloo, fought against an Allied army under Wellington on the 18th of June, 1815. Napoleon, with his new army, was within an inch of victory, only to see victory slip away into defeat, his final defeat at Waterloo. He was imprisoned and sent into exile, this time to the lonely island of St. Helena. This was Napoleon's final humiliation. But it was also God's grace to him. If Napoleon had won the Battle of Waterloo, only God knows where he would have gone on to from there. His pride needed humiliation. On St. Helena, he suffered much. The Pope appealed to the leaders of Europe to help Napoleon in his sufferings. They all took no notice. Napoleon had expressed a desire to die in the Catholic religion with the last sacraments. The Pope himself sent a priest to be Napoleon's chaplain. You see, this great Pope had long since forgiven Napoleon for imprisoning him and for other wrongs. The Pope regarded all that as unimportant, as mere errors of a man carried away by human ambition. The important thing was that Napoleon had restored the Church in France by the Concordat of 1801. The Concordat, said the Pope, was a Christian action, a heroic and beneficial action. Napoleon died on May 5, 1821, after receiving the ministrations of the Catholic Church from his chaplain. As I said, the Pope instituted the Feast of Our Lady Help of Christians, and it seems that Our Lady was pleased by this. 30 years later, in 1844, a saintly young man, Don Bosco, had a vision in which Our Lady showed him a beautiful church. Next year, she again appeared to him, and this time she commanded him to build that same church and to name it the Church of Our Lady Help of Christians. She even specified just where it must be built, on the exact spot in the city of Turin where 3 martyrs had died for the faith. She gave Don Bosco precise instructions on how it was to be built, right down to the last details. Some years later, Don Bosco was ready to start, and he engaged the master builder. But the only money he could offer the builder was 8 cents. Cheerfully, he said, "Don't be alarmed. Our Lady Help of Christians will pay you, and she'll pay you well. You'll see." The builder believed him, and in the Italian city of Turin, on the spot chosen by Our Lady, the church building began. Then, donations of money began to pour in from all parts of the world. Finally, when the church was completed, enough money had come in to pay the whole cost. Not a cent remained owing on the Church of Mary Help of Christians. High up in the church, this sentence was sculptured in Latin: "Maria sibi domum edificavit." Mary built a house for herself, which is exactly what she had done. She had arranged for the land, planned the architecture in detail, and paid for it. Later on, this splendid church was raised to the rank of basilica. Don Bosco himself was canonized in 1934. He is now Saint Don Bosco. As we mentioned, 1844 was the year when Don Bosco had the vision in which Our Lady showed him the church that was to be built. In that year, 1844, an important event happened in a young country called Australia. The Council of Australian Bishops dedicated Australia to Our Lady Help of Christians. The bishops placed Australia under the special protection of Our Lady Help of Christians. She is the patroness of Australia. And now is the time for Australians to turn to her in the perils that grow around us. Now let's have a look at the church that St. Don Bosco built. On the roof there are 2 large statues of angels. One angel carries a banner which shows a date, 1571. 1571, you remember, was the date of the Battle of Lepanto. The second angel faces a statue of Our Lady and is offering her a laurel wreath. However, that was not the original design. In the original design of Don Bosco, the second angel was to hold a banner matching the banner of the first angel, but showing an incomplete date, 19...". We don't know why the design for the second angel was changed. But it would seem that the original design intended that the first angel would remind us that Our Lady Help of Christians saved the church in 1571 at Lepanto. And the second angel would tell us that Our Lady would do the same for the church in 19...". That is, in an unspecified year in our present century. If it was intended as a prophetic message, it apparently was based on a dream which Don Bosco had in 1862. In that dream, he saw a vast sea on which was a ship which was being attacked by many enemy ships. On the deck of that ship, the Pope himself was standing, and he's guiding his ship towards two great pillars, two great columns that rise out of the sea ahead. His ship is struck and battered by enemy bombs and cannons and bullets. Suddenly, the enemy's cannons and guns start to explode on the enemy ships themselves. The enemy's own armaments explode in their own faces. Furiously, the enemy closes in and starts hand-to-hand fighting. The Pope falls wounded. His men help him to rise, but again he is struck, and he falls to the deck and dies. The enemy shouts victory. But immediately, another Pope stands on the deck to replace the dead Pope. The enemy ships waver. Close to the Pope's ship, there are a few friendly ships helping to fight off the enemy. Ahead are the two great pillars in the sea. On top of one pillar is a statue of the Blessed Virgin and an inscription, Auxilium Christianorum, Help of Christians. The other pillar is taller and sturdier. On top of it is a large Eucharistic host and the words, Salus Credentium, Salvation of Believers. At last, the Pope's ship breaks through the enemy lines and he guides his ship between the two pillars and ties it to them. The enemy ships start to run away in panic, but they collide with each other and sink each other. The friendly ships follow the Pope's ship and tie up between the pillars. Then other friendly ships, which had been afraid to join the battle and had stood afar off, seeing the enemy destroyed, they take courage and sail to the two pillars where there is safety and the sea grows calm. Do I need to explain? Well, the Pope's ship is the Catholic Church. The sea is the world. The enemy ships are persecutors seeking to destroy the Church. The ships that help the Pope's ship are good Catholics devoted to helping the Pope and the Church. The two columns are devotion to the Blessed Sacrament and devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary. And it means that these two devotions will save the Church in the coming persecutions. Saint Don Bosco gave the warning a century ago. Very grave trials await the Church. What we suffered so far is almost nothing compared to what is going to happen. Only two things can save us in such a grave hour: devotion to Mary and frequent communion. The dangers to the Catholic Church today, and the dangers to all Christendom today, are perhaps greater than in 1571. Today, the danger is not Islam. It's a worldwide attack by enemies of the Church. Attacks against everything that the Catholic Church teaches. In some parts of the world, the enemies of God have taken over Christian nations and are persecuting Christians and trying to crush Christianity. Throughout the world, all the forces of evil are working to make Catholics and all Christians lose their faith, even in Australia. Australia and the world are flooded with television, radio, newspapers, movies, and even some education, which undermine Christian truths and which weaken Christian morals. Many governments make laws which make legal things which the Church teaches are mortal sins. Things have gone so far, there seems to be no human cure. It seems we're in such danger that Australia must turn to our patroness, Our Lady Help of Christians, must pray to her to save Australia and the world from the new danger. In a later tape, we'll talk about Fatima, Our Lady's appearances at Fatima this century, when she made known the dangers, and how to save the world from them. What it all means is this: great devotion to the Blessed Eucharist and true devotion to Our Lady Help of Christians. It means many prayers, many rosaries to Our Lady under her titles of Help of Christians and Lady of Fatima, The future depends on that.